thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 65, recorded January 19th, 2011. Conference season.
Well, welcome again to Digital Campus. I'm Tom Scheinfeld, in as host this week, or I guess this month. We haven't done done much since the turn of the new year, but we're back with the regulars. Amanda French is here. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Tom.
And that's Amanda French from AmandaFrench.net, and as well as Dan Cohen from DanCohen.org. Hi, Dan.
Happy New Year, Tom.
Happy New Year. And Mills Kelly from EdWired.org. Hey, Mills.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to all and to all of our listeners as well. This being January, I think we can't avoid talking about the big conferences in the humanities, AHA and MLA, which for, I think, the first time happened after the new year this year. Almost coincident, I guess, with AHA. Is that right? They were right?
The first time in living memory, I don't know about back in the early 20th century, but yes, they put it to a vote to the MLA membership as to whether or not to move MLA a bit later, because it used to start pretty much December 27th, and everybody said, yes, let's move it later. So yes, CES, MLA, and AHA were all on the exact same weekend in January.
And I think they got the same amount of press coverage from the technology press, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Sure.
Well, we'll talk about CES a little later in the program. But let's, Amanda, you were at MLA, so why don't we start there? What were the big stories coming out of MLA? I know there was an awful lot of chatter on Twitter, and then some fairly interesting and engaged blog back and forth on a number of different topics, all kind of interrelated, having to do with who is a digital humanist, who gets to play, what role Twitter plays in all of this, and other things. What's your kind of roundup on all of that conversation that came out of MLA?
Well, first I have to say that my perspective may be biased, but I can't help but think that the big story coming out of MLA was indeed digital humanities again this year. Sub note to big story is that so many people on Twitter, but elsewhere, just anecdotally at MLA, also said that it was the first MLA in a long time where they'd actually had a good time. And I think that the role of social media in that is not to be... should not be underplayed. So, number one, there were a lot of digital panels at MLA, and it was amazing for me going. It was about the fourth time I've been to MLA, and it was really the first time where I've really felt part of a discipline, you know, really felt part of a field. Because before I used to know, you know, the people I went to grad school with and one or two people in Victorian poetry, but it was just so massive and overwhelming that those encounters were few and far between. So, you know, but this year I went and I was on a couple of roundtables and I met so many people that I already knew really well from the blogosphere and from Twitter, some of whom I had met at other conferences before. And so it really felt like a smaller conference than it was. And then I got to meet a whole bunch of great new people as well, some of whom are affiliated with the digital humanities, some of whom are not. And, you know, the panels that I was on and the panels that other people were on about digital humanities were also the ones that got the most coverage, it seemed, in Inside Higher Ed and the Chronicle and even in the mainstream press. So
I mean, it seemed like one of the criticisms that came out of the coverage, at least that as it was in Chronicle of Higher Ed and Inside Higher Ed, was that those publications seemed, in some respects, to cover the panels that were heavily tweeted, and that they maybe paid undue attention or excessive attention to the kind of digital. Do you think that was that's fair, or do you think that the coverage and there was, I think, ample coverage of digital humanities in those publications reflected the real rise of digital humanities at the conference?
I think it's a fair criticism. And I have always said and would never deny that Twitter and blogging as well, you know, macro blogging as well as micro blogging, it's such a convenient thing for journalists who are on very tight deadlines. You know, they've got sort of ready-made quotes to lift for their article, which is often just a lot quicker than calling people and getting quotations. Not that they don't do that as well, of course they do, but at the same time, having gone to a lot of those panels, some of the digital humanities panels were packed. I mean, there were a lot of people there in person as well, and not all of them were tweeting. And then I made a real effort to go to non-digital humanities panels, and I went to one or two that were really great. But I really have to say that it's not as though there was one coherent story coming out of MLA that was not the digital humanities. Like, so, say for instance, I went to the big plenary session on the Academy in Hard Times, and granted it was in the evening, it was one of the few evening panels, and by the way, that was another innovation. They got rid of evening panels, which I think most people enjoyed. But this was one of the rare ones where they did keep an evening panel. And it was actually, for a plenary, it wasn't all that well attended. And it was, you know, it was some things that I've heard before about, you know, budget cuts. So that was another big story coming out of MLA, as so many universities and colleges are experiencing tremendous financial hardship. And that, you know, was something that everybody was talking about as well. And I'm sure there were stories covering that as well. But here was a big panel with some great big names on it, and it was not nearly as well attended as I would have thought. I should say too that the other thing coming out of the conference was sort of related to digital humanities, I guess you could say. The theme of the conference was narrating lives, because Sidonie Smith, the president of MLA this year, does a lot of work on life writing. And she's done some very interesting work on life writing on the internet, you know, life writing on Twitter, life writing on blogs, the way we all can, you know, are now our own autobiographers on the internet. And so she had a project that was really neat, where she got a lot of academics to go down to a little booth in the exhibit hall and narrate their lives in a minute. The videos are all up on YouTube. And so you can see where it's this kind of bridge between autobiographical writing and, you know, internet culture, which is something that digital humanities often talks about. And in a way, it would also relate to the theme of the Academy in Hard Times, because a lot of people were talking about their, you know, their lives as adjuncts, you know, distressing economic conditions that they've gone through in order to become a member of the MLA, you know, teaching at a university and part-time as contingent faculty. So, you know, that's another story, but it was not unrelated to digital humanities in that way.
Right, right. Well, I have to make apologies for the three historians on the panel. None of us were as intrepid as you, Amanda, and made the trip, were able to make the trip to AHA, although I think Dan was supposed to and had
to. I was
to,
supposed to go and got too sick to go. I wish I had been there. It did seem to me from afar, and I was watching both hashtags for the AHA and MLA, and obviously, as it's true, been true every year since Twitter existed, obviously the MLA had far more people and tweets. And I have to say, I did find, you know, from afar, from my sick bed, quite literally had my laptop in bed with me, and I was watching, quote unquote, watching both conferences. It does feel, I think because of Twitter, that the MLA was a livelier place to be, that there were things that were going on that I was interested in. And I think, Amanda, as you've just mapped out for us, I mean, maybe the MLA here is starting to kind of conceive of evolving the annual meeting forward into something more than just a job fair with scantly attended panels sort of on the side. Seemed to me that having things like the little photo booth, the YouTube booth, and active blogging, they had a blogger's table, is that right? And also just the array of tweets, which I know, and I mean, this is always true for Twitter, it when you really get underneath the stats, it tends to be the top 10 or 20 people doing most of the tweets. But that's, you know, that's pretty true. But I still think there were quite a few people, I think in the hundreds of people, actually, who tweeted with that hashtag. So it was a bigger circle than last year and bigger each year. So I think this combination of having, you know, relevant, up-to-date issues like the State of the Academy plenary and having social media being a very active part of the conference, maybe this is a model for how to kind of rejuvenate or reconceive the annual meeting.
I should mention, too, this was the very first year, and I'm sure that this applies to the entire 20th century as well as the 21st. This was the very first year that the MLA has had wireless access. It's a very expensive thing for conferences to buy. And, you know, if you've got a smartphone, and I was surprised at how many people had smartphones at MLA this year, that may not always be necessary, but I'm certain, although I can't prove it, that the existence of wireless amped up that social media participation.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't realize how hard it is actually to get blanket Wi-Fi at these conferences. How expensive it is, or how complicated it is to at least for academic conferences. You know, the AHA, for instance, so we're recording this in January 2011, they have already signed a contract with a hotel in New Orleans for 2016. So they're already booked. They have contracts signed, and those contracts include things like wireless in them, I believe. Even at this early date, they're kind of package deals that they pay X number of hundreds of thousands of dollars to get lower room rates and, you know, get all the space reserved. And so, you know, it's just very hard to reopen these negotiations to fold into that blanket Wi-Fi, which, you know, you'd think at this point would be de rigueur. So, you know, I think a lot of the scholarly societies, not just the MLA and the HA, but across the board, they're now, you know, only now realizing, oh boy, we have to go back to the hotel and see if we can get some kind of better Wi-Fi coverage if we want to have this kind of very lively social media part of it. You know, a lot of these rooms are also in dead zones, I think probably quite intentionally, you know, underground in places where you do have to pay the hotel to get internet access. And so I think it's going to become increasingly important, and people are going to demand it to kind of go back and get this kind of Wi-Fi access across the entire conference area.
Well, it also creates a disequilibrium between the people in the audience and the people up at the front of the room, because the people in the audience, many of them have Wi-Fi access either through their phones or through the, you know, they've gone ahead and paid the hotel for that daily access fee, where the people in the front of the room, unless they've paid the daily access fee themselves, they're not getting access through the conference. And so, you know, they're not online, and the people in the audience are, and that's just kind of strange.
Yeah, I mean, I think that blanket Wi-Fi in that way, Mills, I think has in some ways the most potential to change the kind of power dynamic, whatever you want to call it, between the presenter and the audience, and it, in some ways has there's an opportunity to kind of level that relationship out a bit and maybe reconfigure how these panels, the format of these panels, and how these panels play out. I want to get to, as I said, there were sort of several debates surrounding the digital humanities that came out of MLA, at least. And I was, as Dan was, watching the Twitter stream for both conferences pretty closely. And I have to say, like Dan, I in some ways felt like MLA this year was more my conference than AHA. even being a historian. But there were some debates that came out of it, including things like the role of Twitter, whether digital humanities was or was not the big story, or whether it should have been or not, and you know, the role of, quote, stars in digital humanities. But I thought one of the most interesting debates that came out of MLA this year was sparked by a paper given by our colleague and our irregular guest on this podcast, Steve Ramsey. And I had asked Steve to be on the podcast. Unfortunately, he's got to teach. Something Steve Ramsey said in his presentation, which was that the mark of a digital humanist and what really makes a digital humanist is that digital humanists build things, and that even more specifically, digital humanists know how to code. And I think Steve took a pretty broad view of what it meant to code and what it meant to build things, but that he took a very kind of, and this is something sort of dear to my heart because I've written a lot about it, but he took a very kind of method-centric or at least pragmatic view of digital humanities. And I wanted to just get the sense from you guys of what you thought about both how the debate played out and also about the substance of it, and what sort of where you guys come down on this notion of digital humanists are builders. Dan, did you have...
I'll dive into this. Well, hopefully what will not become a morass. I think as this played out in various blogs and tweets, what I find funny about our community, and I view that community as being everyone listening to this podcast and many more, not just scholars, but librarians and museum professionals. We're all very active in these social media like Twitter. And so I think when there are quote-unquote debates, they seem a lot more heated than they really are at the end of the day. I actually think there's more agreement on this matter than one might imagine. Unsurprisingly, I think our audience will know that I come down in favor of the building. I think that there's probably too much emphasis on the coding. Excuse me for my phone ring, if you can hear that in the background. I think what Steve was trying to get at was that it is important to actually do things in the digital humanities. So I think it was less of a discussion of, you know, being able to code in Ruby or C++ or PHP or even, let's say, HTML, than just the actual act of trying to make something. I think in our fields, the impact of digital media and technology on academia and library and museums, if you don't actually make something, it's kind of hard to know what the real problems and questions and issues are. So I
really agree with that, Dan. And there's actually a quote from Steve's blog post that I think is, I kind of really get behind. Building is for us a new kind of hermeneutic, Steve said. And it's
I think that's a
fancier
great
way of saying what you said, that you can't understand what some of the issues are unless you've at least tried to build, to code.
Right. I like giving an example that Tom and Mills will know a lot about, but here at the center, where we co-produce the September 11th Digital Archive with the American Social History Project in New York, and it was something that we did rather rashly. I mean, it was conceived about a week after 9/11. We had to apply for some funding to pay programmers and historians and web designers to work on it. But it was set up relatively quickly, as these things go. Just a few months after the event, it was up and running. I remember at that point talking to a lot of people, talking to archivists and librarians about, you know, how we should save this born digital material, accounts of 9/11, photographs, email. And I think a lot of people were saying, well, we have to get the metadata structure right, and we sort of have to think about what memorialization means and how we're going to vet the material, since we were acquiring it over the web. How are we going to tell if people are lying or if they're pretending to be someone that they're not? But it was actually only in the act of getting the site actually up and running in a kind of 0.1 version and kind of iterating through that process and seeing of what actually came in, We were kind of surprised about the kinds of things that came in. It actually ended up that the question of validity and verification and provenance ended up actually being a red herring as we looked at what came in and saw the ways in which we could sort of validate it electronically and through other means. And so the questions that actually came up about that project as a very early Born Digital Archive ended up being totally different ones than what than I would have anticipated in advance. So I actually have limited patience, actually, for going to conferences where academics, scholars, and here I will leave aside, let's say, librarians and archivists and museum professionals, because I tend to think they know what's going on because they've been in both a theoretical and a practical world. But when I'm at conferences that are among historians or literary scholars who might skew maybe more toward the theoretical side, and I hear someone sort of imagining a digital tool or imagining a digital collection or archive that has certain features, I do want to, I have that feeling that Steve has of saying, you know, well, you know, you really have to get your hands dirty and actually try doing that. You can't just imagine something that will produce some kind of new scholarship without really trying to build it and realizing that, Amanda, as you quoted from Steve, that there's just a kind of interpretive angle here, or hermeneutic to the process itself that just can't be anticipated ahead of time.
Well, and this actually relates to something I said on the last podcast, which Dorothy Asalo called me on, you know, perhaps rightly, where I quoted a little bit out of context my statement that librarians should get over their service ethic. And what I meant by that was partly it's because, you know, most librarians have that pragmatic experience. Librarians should get over the service ethic because they should value what they do as having, as being interpretation, as being, you know, something that's scholarly valuable in itself. Archivists and librarians who are building digital repositories know what some of the issues are in a way that scholars who are only doing the kind of commentary don't necessarily do. And I was on a roundtable, called Labor in the Digital Humanities, where this issue was sort of pre-raised before Steve really raised it in a big way at his panel. But and Carl Stommer had brought up the point. He straight out said, if you want to be successful as a scholar, you should not learn to code. Because, he said, I've looked at the CVs of several of the, you know, top people in DH, I think he was kind of saying of the previous generation, and none of them actually do the building. And his point was that you get tracked into this sort of secondary academic role if you're the tech guy. You become that service professional, you know, the one who's there to make the scholar's vision a reality, and that's somehow kind of a secondary position. And it's, you know, that was the kind of thing that sparked this whole conversation, because other people, Steve included, have said that's simply not true. You know, this is a nice factual area of investigation. You know, you take the top DHers, you know, you'll have to decide who they are and, you know, rate their level of codiness, you know.
Well,
to
and
what degree
I,
do they actually code? So.
Yeah, and I want to just second what Dan said, but in a slightly different way, and that's, I'm finishing up on a book, and so I'm starting to, as all everybody does when they're trying to finish something, they start thinking about the next thing so they don't have to think of the thing that they're trying to finish.
Exactly.
And so I've been thinking about the next book-like thing that I'm going to do, and I'm, you know, when I wrote my dissertation, when I wrote my first book, and as I've been writing the second book, I knew what the physical form of the thing was going to be, and I knew how people were going to access it. They were either going to pick it up and open it up the way that we do with books, or they were going to read it on a website, the second book anyway, they'll read it on a website, but still just as pages on a screen, either on a website or on some other kind of reader, but it's still a book in that way. The next project that I'm going to work on is going to take me several years to complete, as history projects generally do. And so I've had to think to myself, okay, what's going to be the physical nature of reading in 2014 or 2015? And it's not going to be for everybody picking up a book. It's not going to be just flipping pages on a Nook or a Kindle or something like that, or on an iPad. It's going to be probably something in addition to those. Those things will still happen, but it's going to be something in addition to those. And what would that look like? And so right from the very start, I've had to think about how I'm going to organize the information that I create so that it's readable in the broadest sense of the term. And that's a very interesting and challenging thing to think about. I know how to write a book. I don't know yet how to do the thing that I have to do with this next project.
Sort of tying together some of what you just said, Mills, and some of what Dan and Amanda said. You know, I think Dan and I have been spending this intersession, I guess, December and January, editing the Hacking the Academy volume, where we put out a call and collected 300 plus submissions of various writings on the subject of Hacking the Academy from hundreds of contributors. I think we found absolutely the same thing, that when we collected all of that material, almost all of which is very good, we didn't really know what the final form of it would be. We knew that we would probably have something that would be on paper, that would be bound in some way and that could sit on a shelf. And we knew that we would probably have something that was a website of some sort, and that it would exist in at least those couple of forms. But I think until we actually, I actually think this applies to writing projects and media projects as much as it does to archival and collections projects or tool building projects. I don't think we knew what the format, what the scholarship would look like, until we, you know, sort of sat down with it and cut and pasted a whole bunch of stuff and moved it around in WordPress and looked at the different styles it was written in, looked at the different media it was produced in, looked at the different kinds of authorship implied by the contributions. And I think, you know, we're still actually sorting through that process, but it's the act of actually doing that work that informs, you know, what the final product is going to be. And so if we had tried to say, this is what the book is going to look like, in advance of the call, I think we would have hemmed ourselves in unnecessarily and not gotten the most out of the digital media that we were working in. So,
but just to take this a little further, I mean, yes, I get that completely, but the situation I'm now spinning my head around is that I have to take that into account in advance so that as I begin to create knowledge, I do it in a way that's going to be readable in the broadest sense to a whole variety of different kinds of audiences. And that's really different from just trying to write a book. And so you guys got to confront
absolutely.
It in a very practical way by just asking for things, and things came in, and then you had to figure out how to deal with it. I'm trying to figure out how to deal with it at the front end, and, you know, which may be a fool's errand, but at least I'm going to try to do that.
Yeah, I agree with that, Mills. And I guess the point I was trying to make is that even when we're dealing with words, at this point, even when we're dealing with text, when you venture into the digital environment, you know, you end up with that same set of questions and problems, and in fact, ways of working that you would in building a tool or building a digital collection. Well, I think that this is an ongoing discussion. I tend to agree with Dan that some of the debate of it is overblown, and really, in some respects, there's a devil in the details that maybe we don't need to go in. But I thought it was one of the interesting things coming out of MLA this year, and thought we'd
a footnote on this, Tom, is I am hoping that AHA 2012 will have quite a few panels of the type that were at MLA. So that's my guarantee right here on this podcast.
All right, we'll hold you to that, and we'll look forward to it next year. The much less interesting conference that was going on at the same time as AHA and MLA, as Amanda said, was the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. I don't think anything of particular interest to this podcast came out of that, but we should probably talk a little bit about the announcements that are coming out of the wider world of tech and gadgets and consumer electronics. On this podcast, I guess we'll deign to cover the trade show. Anything struck you, Amanda, from from CES? Anything coming out of there that seems particular interest to you?
Oh, honey, I think you overestimate my ability to follow two big conferences at the same time. I was at MLA, and I mean, I think it was like days after that I learned. I was like, oh my gosh, the iPhone went to Verizon, which ordinarily would have been such huge news. And I mean, I think I caught it like several days after it happened. So I have no idea.
Well, good for you. I'm glad you're paying attention to your scholarship rather than, like me, following the tech blogs by the minute to see what the next...
It does seem like it was... I thought the best headline, I think, was that CES was the year of the iPad, which wasn't even there. You know, it was sort of, you know, all of these, you know, if imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, there was a lot of iPad flattery at CES. And I think we've been talking on this podcast for a year now about how the idea of a tablet or slate will have an impact on academia. And I think we've said repeatedly on the podcast that we were sort of waiting around for the cheap Android clones. And I think a lot of Android clones were shown, but whether they're cheap or not remains to be seen. I thought it was fascinating that, I mean, if you really want to say that 2011 is the year of the tablet in general, not the iPad, and its impact in education, I think we've all been waiting around for the $199 or even the $99
right
tablet. And I think that the missed story that the tech news is sort of heard of tech outlets missed is that I don't think people realize how expensive these things are actually to make, even though they don't have a keyboard. And the fact that Apple has been very shrewd about pre-purchasing parts, very necessary parts, everything from little 1 cent chips to the screen, in such a way that I think they're going to be still in the lead for a long, long time, in just because of the pricing of these things. There were probably 40 tablets announced at the conference, and none of them had pricing, or maybe one of them had pricing.
No, and none of them are coming to market immediately.
None of them are coming to market. So by the time they're out, there'll be an iPad 2, which will be better and probably still will be $499, or they'll drop the price of the iPad 1 to $399, and I just think that you know, and the stat that was out this week was that Apple had 89% of the tablet market in 2010. That's even after the Galaxy Tab, which was the most successful of these Android tablets, came out, which was in fact smaller, literally half the size. A 7-inch tablet is half the size, screen size, of an iPad, which is 10 inches. It's not 70%. It's literally less than half, actually, the size at 7 inches. And that was the cost the same as the iPad. So, you know, if we're talking about getting this into the hands of students in college, or even more at a more sensitive price point in the K-12 market, it's really got to be down at the price of $99 or $149 or $199. And I think it's just literally not possible at this point for any of these tablets to make that price point without making very, very significant compromises.
Yeah, I think when we were talking about the imminent slate, as iSlate, I think we were calling it back a year ago, before the iPad was announced, the rumor was it was coming, and everyone knew it was coming. And in fact, it was the talk of CES last year, even before it came out. I think everyone was expecting it to come in at the kind of $999 price point. And, you know, I think it was a big story when it came in at $500. But I don't think people realized just how shrewd that move really was. And what did I think? I think you're absolutely right, Dan, is what it did was it allowed Steve Jobs and Apple to hold this market to the essentially to themselves, to keep the market to themselves for a couple of years. Really, probably it'll be 18 months before there's really a slew of viable competitors. And in that 18 months, you can do a lot of market consolidation. And since Apple is, I think, you know, people will agree, a fairly closed ecosystem, once people have bought into that ecosystem, it's pretty hard to get out. And so they will have wrapped up a big part of this market by coming in at that low price point.
Yeah. And that, so it's going to kill the, you know, there's been a lot of startups, educational startups. There's this Nope company, KNO, which is, you know, been talking about, they're going to have an education-specific tablet. In fact, they showed off one that was slightly larger than the iPad, and then one that had actually two tablets sort of hinged together. But the pricing on it is so much higher. And the fact that, as you just said, Tom, by the time they're out, okay, maybe they'll have the big textbook makers on board. But, you know, if you're a student, would you rather pay $899 for a weird no tablet that has your textbooks on it? Or would you rather get an iPad that can play Angry Birds in HD and movies and your iTunes collection and also get the textbooks on it? I mean, I just don't, it just sucked the air out of the entire market.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. You know, other announcements, big announcements actually just coming this week out of Apple, though. It looks like Steve Jobs is going to be taking a medical leave, and I think we'll have to see. You know, I think that anyone who's interested in tech will wish him well, but I think we'll have to see what comes out of that and whether, you know, a lot of people think Apple is a bit of a one-man show, and we'll see. In the past, when he's taken medical leaves and come back fighting, Apple's done very well. So let's hope for that. Other news coming out of the tech world. I think we've, as Dan said, I think we have seen a lot of these tablets, and I think we've also seen a lot of new cultural heritage and educational apps coming out for the iPad and iPhone in particular, but also for Android devices. Mills, you've been following some of these educational apps. Can you give us a little bit of a rundown?
Yeah. You know, I think it's very interesting now that you were in this connects to our conversation about being a builder or not, that increasingly we're seeing apps available, especially for smartphones that, or for tablet devices that are just going to make life easier for academics, either classroom management apps like keeping roll in your class, or you know, or tracking student performance on various projects, that sort of thing, or lecture preparation apps, the, you know, sort of mind mapping software, those kinds of things that can then easily publish those notes to the website or to your blogs for your students to have access to, things for reading scholarly articles. They're just and these are all being created by teachers or professors rather than for people, sort of by people outside the industry. I mean, it kind of fits with that ethic of the app creator who, you know, sees a need, wishes there was an app for X, Y, or Z, and just makes one. And so we're starting to see more and more people who are in the classroom creating those kinds of apps. And I think this is going to be an accelerating trend because there are so many, you know, engines now that make it easier to write some of this code, or you can sit down with a grad student who is a better coder, or an undergrad who's a better coder than you, and say, I really need to be able to do X, Y, or Z on my phone or on my tablet. I mean, I personally am really looking forward to the day that I don't cart my laptop to the classroom anymore. That's going to be a very happy day for me. And so being able to run my course either from my phone or from a tablet is I think it's not going to revolutionize education. It's going to revolutionize the sort of the working life of the teacher or the faculty member at the university. So I'm very hopeful about this. I think in the coming year we're going to see more and more of these beginning to appear. And as they do in the app universe, you know, there'll be competing versions and, you know, sort of slapped together, and then increasingly professionalized versions, and none of them will be Angry Birds, which apparently Dan seems to be kind of devoted to, but certainly they're gonna make people's lives easier, and so I'm excited about it.
One of the things I actually kind of worry about is with this kind of, and I worry about it in general with the app revolution, but I worry about it in particular for digital humanities and educational technology, teaching and learning, is that, you know, it used to be that the intrepid, digitally minded professor would go and build him or herself a cool course website, you know, sort of forget about Blackboard and go and build your course blog or your course wiki or your course website. And that was that was always a learning experience for the professor and for the students. And I think it spurred a lot of innovation. I think, you know, the fact that you a fairly large number of people could kind of get their hands dirty with the transparent technologies of HTML and even PHP, the very kind of transparent, relatively easy to use, kind of relatively human readable languages of HTML and the web scripting languages. I think that bred a lot of innovation. I worry that as the expectation becomes that, you know, you have a course app rather than a course website, and I do believe that coding apps is sort of an order of magnitude more difficult and less transparent to the amateur, that we're going to end up even more in the hands of the big learning management systems, that fewer and fewer people are going to be able to kind of DIY their own apps. So while I'm excited about these applications and the opportunities that the iPad and other tablets and mobile operating systems afford for education, I worry about the kind of closing a space for innovation that the web afforded us. Anybody else have thoughts on whether, you know, sort of this app revolution is a good or a bad thing?
I'll just one side note on this that I don't think we got to discuss last year at all, but we are finally starting to see some software development kits and higher level languages that allow, I think maybe not the person who doesn't have any programming skills at all, but maybe people at digitally knowledgeable people like the people listening to this podcast to be able to very easily make apps for both iOS, iPhone, iPads, and Android. So I don't know if you've been following this 14-year-old who's got the number one downloaded game on iTunes right now called Bubble Ball. Robert Ney, he's an eighth grader in Utah, and he's been programming for a couple years, basic things, HTML, PHP, things like that. But he picked up a software development kit that actually spits out apps both for Android and for iOS. And I think more and more that's going to happen, especially now that Apple backed off a little bit using third-party software development kits. So I think this might be a hidden story that people didn't realize, but you can actually now write once and push out to different kinds of devices. I think he used Lua, which is a kind of C derivative that the software development kit that he used, which is the Corona SDK, uses. So I think more and more that's going to happen. I think, you know, obviously it'll have to be even higher than Lua, which does have syntax that looks a lot like C and is a little bit more complicated. But I think there will be higher level programming environments to be able to do things. I mean, maybe not as easy as writing a basic website for your course, but it could be that we could get to some easier space. I mean, the problem though is still that, you know, I'd rather that they be websites than apps, right? I mean, it does balkanize things, even with these kind of higher order languages and software development kits.
Yeah, I think I was sort of encouraged by, I think Google has one of these SDKs that's kind of visual, where I haven't taken a good look at it and I can't even remember the name of it, but something where you sort of drag and drop pieces to build Android apps. I think hopefully we see more of that, but again, I like you, Dan, I still worry a little bit about it.
I Yeah, I agree, Tom. I mean, I think it's a bit of a problem, I mean, not only for teachers, but for publishers. I mean, really what Mills was talking about earlier, you know, the notion of what form my thing should be in is a big problem for DHers and for museums and for libraries. You know, there's this, I was listening to some journal editors at MLA talk about that exact problem. You know, there's this expectation now that you should be on all the e-readers, and that's actually an enormous amount of work. But I do think you're right, Dan, in that we're kind of at the stage now with mobile apps that we used to be with websites, where you used to have to know HTML to build a website, and you know, that was not that hard, but still, you know, kind of, it was definitely a leap for most people. But now, you know, if you want to build a website, I mean, it's as easy as going somewhere and entering your email and clicking submit, and you can type into a text box and create a website. And so I think it'll at some point, who knows when, it'll become almost that easy to put your website on the iPhone in an app way. You know, I mean, really, of course you can anyway. You can optimize your website for the iPhone, and then people can put a little shortcut on there.
Right. I mean, I guess that's the question, is whether people will feel obliged to create an app. Or whether it will be okay to have just a bookmarkable website that uses CSS to tailor it to the particular device.
I think that's if anybody's listening who does feel that urge to be on the mobile space, you know, that's a pretty good solution already, is you can implement a mobile theme in WordPress or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's an open question, and I think we're going to still have to wait and see how that app versus HTML5 question plays out. Well, that's about all the time I've got today, guys. But it was really good talking to all of you. Not a lot of whole lot of news this time, but it was good to have a chance to throw out some ideas and opine on things digital. Thanks.
We should probably remind listeners that they can always get in touch with us. You know, if you at us at Digital Campus on Twitter with story ideas, we're always happy to take them.
I think
for everyone.
And email us as well, or comment on any of the threads on the blog at digitalcampus.tv. We're always paying attention there, and we really welcome any kind of feedback that people want to give us. Thanks, Dan. Well, thank you to all of you, Dan Cohen, Mills Kelly, Amanda French. We'll see all of you next time on another Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Thank you.